Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Bereaved, a novel by Julia Park Tracy, narrated by Avon Shore. Martha, Martha, thou art worried and troubled about many things. Luke chapter 10, verse 41. Prologue. Newburgh, New York, October 1859. My man Bram died on a Saturday evening, when all the world and its children take their baths. He was just 33. The boys, Ira, 12, and George, 6, were sharing their bathwater at the folks' house, where I'd sent them to stay clear of the sick air, and my big girl, Sarah, 13, was up there, too, to keep an eye on them. "No misbehaving before the grand folks," I said. "Respect your elders and be silent at table, not like home." Sarah said she'd see to it. Homer stayed with me, as he was still on the teat. I wanted to keep them safe from whatever dread disease crept through Bram's veins and wept through his skin. Doctor had said he thought it was measles, then camp fever, and it turned out he was right the second time, though Bram hadn't been near any camp. The field hands, passing through with help for harvest, mayhap, they were Irish. They might have borne lice, which brought on camp fever. The burly men scratched at themselves when they paused for a drink of water or a pipe, and I suspected nits the time that orange-haired girl came by the little house. I told her to wait outside, fetched the bucket of buttermilk down cellar myself, and sent her, scratching, away. I want to itch my own scalp now, thinking back on it. Not a week later, Bram came in from the barn, bits of straw fluttering off his sleeves and a sharp pain in his head, squinting at the golden autumn sun. I put him right to bed. Within a few hours, he was fevered and chilled by turns. I sent Ira afoot to the doctor's house and bid Sarah take George to the big house, to their young aunties. I kept Homer as far away as I could, instead of snug in the big bed with his mama and papa. I laid him on a quilt on the floor with a spool to gnaw while I simmered broth and spooned it into Bram. I sopped my own bread and ate it standing, while dirty sheets boiled white again and Bram moaned and sweated and fluxed. The days ran together while I fought for Bram's life. In those dark hours I prayed and cried, rocked my baby, sponged my husband, begged and muttered to an indifferent God. But before Bram breathed his last, I had known. I heard it coming as clear as the rumble of a train far down the tracks. It didn't matter now where he'd caught this fever, where the rough red rash had come from. The only thing that counted to me and our four children is that Abram Lozier, my husband, their father, was dead. That Saturday night I sat with my late husband's body, holding his heavy hand while his dead body cooled at last, my damp cloth no use to him now, my whispered pleas just a hiss of air between my lips for all the good they'd done. His blue eyes still peeked beneath his dark lashes, and I pressed the lids down again and again, but they would open, his blue gaze upon me as if to say he was sorry. "I'm sorry, too," I thought, scared and sad, so deep I felt faint. "What will we do now? Where will we go? Where shall we stay? Must I ask the favor of your folks to keep us? What will become of us in this new cold world? I've been alone before, been Martha to suit my name for all my 31 years, but with children now?" My heart hammered and then seemed to stop, and I felt my panic rising like foam in a pot. Homer, heavy as a smoked ham, drowsed in my elbow, a string of white drool at his mouth. I set him on the trundle bed near the wall where he couldn't roll off and tucked the quilt around him. Thank the Lord for this sweet lump, his brown hair mussed, fat fists curled as he snuggled into dreams. Homer kept me anchored. Meanwhile, the bedroom stank like baby flannels and sick, sour as a milk pan left unscrubbed. I had spent 10 days attending my husband, barely seeing the children, greeting them through the crack of the door. But work never ends. When morning came, the women would come. We'd wash and dress Bram in his crisp white shirt, his fine broadcloth suit, and pin his tie in place, every stitch from my own needle. Blue socks I'd knitted and darned, the color of my eyes, he'd called his favorite color. Polished boots on his feet, one of my finely hemmed handkerchiefs in his pocket for the hereafter. Charlotte and Malcolm, Bram's folks, would have a coffin made in town, and there'd be a funeral at the Dutch Reformed Church, and then Bram would be tucked into the family plot near our two other babies, with a space at his side for me. Between now and then I'd better sew black bands on the children's clothes and dye Sarah's plain brown dress black. She was old enough to wear proper mourning at her age, so her dress must grieve with her. And there should be food for callers. We'd offer them donuts and pie, cider from the barrel, and me with two floors to scrub before the folks knocked at the door in the morning, and any small thing that Charlotte might fault in the management of my little house she would notice. I was tired. Bram was dead. I was still Martha, toiling instead of praying. There was so much for the newly bereaved to do. No time for tears. Chapter 1. Otisville, New York, 1840. I'd been on my own, or alone in some way or another, a nobody, having to learn what to say and do without much guidance since I was young. I remember a little of my papa, Ira Sabolt, before he died. I am the eldest of five sisters, with an idle mama. I thought I would be papa's boy and help him in the fields, but I am not tall, and my figure has always been stick-thin, no matter how much new milk I drank. Papa used to tweak my nose and call me Button and let me drive the horses pulling a big wain of Indian corn from the field. When I was 10, he cut his leg with a dull scythe, and the wound went sour. I can still hear him groaning through locked teeth, his neck cords tight as a braided whip, his harsh cough as he choked on his own juices. After he passed, Mama went home with the three littlest girls to her Greenleaf folks down Hudson's River, and sent Sister Amelia, 7, with me to Grandmother Sabolt up in Otisville. The Sabolts sometimes spoke German to each other if they didn't want us to understand, but I knew they were speaking of my mother, Mary. Amelia was not a strong child, and when we caught the whooping cough, I lived, but she withered and sank too fast. I was left alone in the trundle bed with flickering shadows from the fireplace in Grandmother's house, and Uncle John's loud boots on the floor. The house was warm, but so much quieter than a house full of children. Grandmother, her brown eyes still lively in a lined face, gave me cake with dried cherries in it, hot coffee with thick whipped cream spooned on top, and the juices of her roasted pork with apples and cabbage cooked in a great iron pot. She combed out my mousy hair and braided it up tight in loops to my ears. When I stopped coughing and was well enough to get up, she sat beside me and taught me to sew, starting with a rag doll, then a doll's quilt of matched squares and blocks of 9, and showed me how the 9 patches could be stacked with white spaces between to make a pattern. Mama had not come to see Amelia laid in the ground and wrote to me but infrequently. I knew how to knit and darn, but I had never sewn a dress by myself. So after the dolls' things, while we were waiting for the fall winds to blow and the windows to frost, we cut through cotton muslin woven in a mill in one of the great cities of the north. I threaded my needle to make the pattern dress before cutting the woolen cloth Uncle John had brought back from New York City. I went to the schoolhouse in the winter and summer terms, helping Grandmother with harvest preserves and hog butchering in the fall, hoeing the kitchen garden in the spring. Grandmother gave me a silver thimble, and I have used it since that day to sew every stitch of my clothing and my husband's and for every one of my 6 children, including baptism burial dresses for the babies. Grandmother taught me to stitch a heart inside the neck yoke or placket of every shirt and chemise and gown, to hold my love for the wearer against their necks, their hearts. Sometimes I stitched in red thread for my husband and my babies, even though the red might bleed. I still think about those bleeding hearts under the ground sometimes, if my babies are cold, are dank and moldering, or if they are warm and dry and just sleeping in death, as the Reverend Van Horn said. Grandmother's hands were as gnarled as an old plum tree, and though she could sew, kneading dough was too hard on her bones. I learned to bake the light wheat bread and the rye bread loaf the German way, saving the crumbs from each cutting to make the loaf darker the next time. She was a great believer in the Lord and Bible stories, but also remembered many folk tales from her grandmother's. Stories of dark woods with hungry witches and greedy dwarves, trolls under bridges and farm animals that played instruments or spoke on Christmas Eve. When I completed a task or threaded her needle, she always acknowledged me. "I thank you, Martha." With a sincerity I learned to trust and revere, knowing she truly loved me. On an early winter day, before the first real frost, I awoke and found Grandmother was still abed. I thought I would surprise her by making morning coffee the German way, mit Schlag, that delicious thick cream, and have it ready when she rose. I cranked the grinder, inhaling the dark, savory scent of fresh coffee grounds while the kettle hissed over the banked fire. Uncle John made the fires, so I left it for him to build up, and whipped last night's cream in a yellow bowl with a fork until my arm ached. When the grounds settled in the pot, I poured a jet of fresh caffè into Grandmother's Dresden cup and spooned a jaunty cap of the whipped cream on top. I could not wait to see her smile when she came to table. She still had not arisen, despite my kitchen noises. Uneasy now, I approached the bedside. Grandmother stared at me from a face frozen and contorted in a grimace. "Grandmother, are you ill? Do you hurt?" She could not form words. Her brown eyes blinked, and a groan, the kind an idiot makes in the village square, came up from her throat. I ran up the stairs to Uncle John's room, calling him, and he went down faster than I came up.
"Mother, mother,"
I heard him, desperate, saw him rubbing her crooked hand between his. He turned to me.
"Fetch my boots and cloak. I'll go for the doctor."
I stayed near and held Grandmother's hands, tried to gently uncurl them from the twist they'd formed overnight. She could only look at me and blink. By the time doctor arrived with a jangle of cloak and boots and his leather bag, she had fallen asleep. I went back to the kitchen where Grandmother's Dresden cup sat, cold caffè with a scum of wilted cream. I poured it into my own cup and drank it that way, afraid to waste it, afraid of what was amiss, unable to stop it from happening in our dark, shared room. Doctor called it a stroke of paralysis and said she would get well slowly or not at all. I baked bread that day because I must keep my hands and mind busy, and served my uncle his meals, tried to get Grandmother to take some broth from a spoon, but it only ran down the sheet. Uncle John paced the floor all the day and wrote letters, stopping to look at the bedroom door and curse softly into his fist. I barely slept in my trundle next to Grandmother's bed, listening for her breath, her cry for help. There was no sound in the dim room but my own sniffles and muffled sobs. Grandmother Sable was dead in the morning, her warmth gone and her dear face frozen in that grimace, unable to say her final prayers, her heart stilled but never forgotten. Uncle John arranged her burial, quickly before the ground froze, and we stood in the churchyard among all the late Sables and departed neighbors and laid her in the grave. Spinster cousins came up from Middletown and Mount Hope to help wait on Uncle John and asked him what he meant to do all alone in the house with a young niece almost 16. The cousins stayed, taking Grandmother's bed, and I knew I was moving on. After Grandmother Sable passed, I wrote my mother asking if I could come to her at last. She wrote back quickly this time, to say that she had married again, to her cousin Mr. Tooker, and that his house was full of her little daughters, his mother, and sisters. He was building a new home in Philadelphia, she wrote, and I might visit them next winter, but in the meantime I must go to her brother in Newburgh. Your new father sends his regards. I had not seen Mama since Papa died, and I wondered if she even remembered me when she wasn't holding my letter in her hand. I didn't know how to feel about my new father. I felt nothing, I suppose. I just wanted a home where I could sit with a needle and thread and with a window on the world. I showed Mama's letter to my Uncle John, and he frowned at her childish scrawl. He didn't curse aloud, but he looked thunderous.
"Such a mother," he finally said. "Too busy counting ribbons to keep track of her own children."
He chucked me under the chin and promised,
"I'll drive you down to Newburgh myself, Martha."
Over the clucking of his miserly cousins, he bought me a new trunk with brass hinges and a lock to pack my belongings, and gave me grandmother's silk needlebook to remember her, her yarns and hooks and the two quilts we had made together. The bright nine patch and the blue and green Ohio star cushioned the bottom of the trunk. My clothes and sewing filled the rest. My mother's brother, Uncle Daniel Greenleaf, owned farmland out in the countryside, but he worked in the town as an agent for insurance, with chambers on Water Street and a fashionable wife, Aunt Rebecca. They had two young children, Johnny and Helen. I was to help care for the little ones and be at hand for my aunt in any way she asked, for my keep. I was glad to be around babies again. I had missed my little sisters, growing up away from them. Raising babies isn't so hard when you like them to begin with. A few days latterly, Uncle John drove me and my trunk with a load of hay from Otisville down the chilly country to Newburgh Town, to my Uncle Greenleaf's big house on a cobbled street, pulling up behind the stable on Grand Street to unload. Though Uncle's wagon was a good one, after 5 hours in the open air on that rattling seat, my hands were stiff and cold, and so was my breech. I was relieved to go inside and warm by the keeping room's fireplace. My Aunt Rebecca, whom I had met long ago but had not seen for years, came into the room gliding toward me like a skater across the ice. She wore a dark green gown with the most elegant point to her basque waist and a similar V-shaped opening at her neck. The dress was patterned with black leaves over a forest-colored ground, and the tiny pearly buttons were black as jet. Her sleeves were wrist-length and so fitted they seemed like long gloves. I could not stop gazing at the magnificence of her gown. My aunt, as short as I am but rounder, with bright eyes and the color of hair they call strawberry, took my cold hands in hers and shook them as if I were a grown-up person. She smiled into my face. "Are you frozen, my dear? It's positively arctic out there." "No, not too cold," I fibbed. I was so relieved that she was kind and friendly. "Come in and meet the children and find your bed upstairs. We are pleased to have you, and the children are so looking forward to meeting their cousin." She smiled again, and it seemed that was her favorite thing to do, be cheerful. I hoped so. Aunt Rebecca took me by the arm very companionably and brought me through to a downstairs parlor where the children played before a screened fire, Helen on the floor with a cloth book and some rag toys, and Johnny with a Noah's Ark carved of wood. He was setting up his animal kingdom and making the sounds of wild creatures in a low tone. He growled up at his mother and looked at me with mischief in his eyes.
"Rawr!"
"Jonathan, is that any way to greet your cousin Martha?" "Goodness, are you a bear?" I asked, bending over to see.
"Tiger."
He held up a carved shape daubed with black and orange stripes. "Tiger, Johnny," Aunt urged. "Tiger."
"Tiger."
Aunt looked at me and said, "We must improve his speech. You'll help, won't you?" The tiger began to fight a camel, and Johnny's dialogue returned to growls and squeals. Little Helen flapped the cloth pages at her mama and raised her arms to be picked up. Aunt took her baby girl in arms and smoothed the baby's strawberry curls. "This one needs a hair ribbon or a cap. Her tresses are most unruly. And look at this face." The scolding words were spoken in the most loving of tones as Aunt wiped her child's drooly chin with a handkerchief. I held my hands out to Helen to see if she would come to me, and she looked at me with round eyes, then hid her face in her mother's neck. I knew how she felt, shy of strangers, longing for reassurance. "Let us go up to your bedchamber, shall we, and bring your coat and cap. Your Uncle Daniel will bring up your trunk before supper, and you will make yourself comfortable, the way you like things best. But I am parched for a cup of tea, and I believe you must be so. Very well." And as it began, so it continued. The Greenleafs absorbed me into their household with kindness, but I had much to learn. I was a town girl now, no forest walks or farm chores. I could read and write and figure, but there was no more call for school. The household employed Nola, the Scotch girl in the kitchen, to scrub and stew, and I wasn't expected to bake bread or mend fires. I was neither child nor adult, not servant, but not quite of the family. I took the children for walks and gave them their baths, and I was permitted to run errands alone for my aunt and uncle, provided I did not actually run. I crocheted lace instead of sewing quilts, and gazed out my high window at the wonders of town. I loved to walk down the streets of Newburgh to take a message to my uncle's chamber of offices, to stop and look in shop windows on Montgomery and Water Streets, and to notice every detail on the clothes of women who passed by. Cartridge pleats, white manchette cuffs, encore necklines, pelerines with a sharp point at the front, silk shawls and the Jenny Lind collar, named for the famous Swedish singer who had been pictured in the pages of Godey's ladies' book. My eyes could not get enough of the rich details that could be sewn into darts, pleats, plackets, and piping, much less tassels, fringe, and lace. And I didn't even want to wear such clothes. I wanted to craft them. Cloth goods were expensive, so I practiced on the rag bag's leftovers and made wee smocked bonnets and tatted lace collars for Helen and her dolls. I heard Aunt and Uncle speaking of New York City and its stylish salons and playhouses, where well-dressed people filled the halls. Aunt's clothes were made for her by a Newburgh dressmaker, but when she saw what I knew, she allowed me to make more clothes for the children, and then for myself, sparing the expense of a purchased garment or a dressmaker. Soon it was clear that Aunt Rebecca expected another child, and I begged to be permitted to make the christening dress. She bought all the trimmings she desired, and after observing me with the muslin, Aunt Rebecca allowed me to cut into the soft white silk. I spent hours by daylight and by lamplight making the tiny puffed sleeves, the mini rows of pin tucks and gathers. Laid out on the big bed, the pearled gown was almost 4 feet long, enough to drape to the floor in church, from baby's place in its mother's arms. I could not wait to see it on the new child, boy or girl. The finished gown lay in clean white paper when Aunt Rebecca took to her bed and doctor came. But her labor was long, and the infant was not hale, and by the 4th day of his life, I helped clothe the nameless boy in his christening dress just once, for all eternity. The Dutch Reformed Church in Newburgh, with its white columns and wide doorways, sat just blocks up from my uncle's home, on the hill where you could see out across Hudson's River to the town of Beacon. I often saw steam ferries chugging upriver and down, floats of cattle or sheep, and the white sails of boats that preferred to try the wind and shifting tide. On occasion I took a message to invite the Reverend Dr. Van Horn to supper, or to deliver loaves of bread and hard cheese for the poor. We went on Sundays to the long service. The Greenleafs had been with the Dutch church since they left Nantucket Island behind. A well-to-do family from the countryside owned a private pew not far from the Greenleafs' row near the front. I saw their name in the register, heard it spoken in greeting. Lozier, a foreign-sounding name, with that letter Z scratched downward, curving upward in ink, a pleasant buzz in my mouth when I whispered it to myself. The handsome wife, the jolly-looking husband, and so many young daughters I couldn't keep count, 4, 5, and another baby on the mother's arm. There was a boy, older than I, but not too grown, Abram, they said. Abram Lozier. He wore a brown hat and even at 18 bore a shadow on his cheeks, shaven clean for church-going. But later he grew a rich, dark beard. Abram was a solid name, a forefather's name reaching back to Bible times, and his family had farmed in Orange County well before General Washington of Virginia quartered in Newburgh. I watched Abram's back, his passing shoulder, but lowered my eyes when he turned. The Sunday glimpse was enough to dream of for 6 days and nights. First the Z caught my eye, then the dark forelock, deep blue eyes fringed with black lashes looking back in weighted silence, and I wished to be walked home, to be asked to an Appleby, a frolic. My aunt was not well after the baby died, and she did not see visitors, staying in her own dark parlor with curtains drawn and shutters pulled, rocking in a chair by her fire for hours. She seemed old before her time, no longer the cheerful aunt I had met just a year before. She often gave no answer at all when I spoke. Her illness meant I had more work with the children, and less time sewing or walking in town. One spring afternoon, however, Uncle Daniel told Scotch Nola to watch the children and sent me to his attorney, Mr. Charles Montgomery, with papers inside a leather folder. Relieved to get shut of the dispirited house and my sorrowing aunt, I put on my bonnet and walked briskly in May sunshine to Montgomery Street, where the attorney kept his offices. I had never noticed before that the street and the lawyer bore the same name. He must be influential, or rich, I mused. At the front steps, I passed two pretty ladies wearing new summer dresses. One carried a matching parasol with tiny jingle bells attached to each point. The ladies were so bright and fashionable, and my mind was full of their delightful ensembles when I rapped at the door to see Charles E. Montgomery, Esquire, attorney at law. A young clerk in a stiff collar opened the heavy oaken door and showed me to a bench by the attorney's private office. I was not important, just a nobody delivering a paper. But soon the inner office door opened and the great man himself appeared. I recognized him from town, from occasions on the square, when I saw him. His silk waistcoat was a glossy green tartan, and his wavy dark hair, parted on the side, drawn across his forehead, gave him a foppish look. His gray eyes seemed very pale in his tanned face.
"Well, well,"
he looked down at me.
"And who are you?"
"Martha Sabolt, sir. My Uncle Greenleaf sent this for you." I stepped forward to hand the folder to him. He received it and flicked a glance into the folder, set it back on his table. He sat down on the edge of his table in a very casual manner and swung his leg like a country boy.
"Greenleaf's girl, yes. Enchanted to meet you at last."
His voice was smooth as a minister's, and he looked right into my eyes as if raking my soul. He took my hand as if to shake it, but he was very close, and I was not used to shaking hands with gentlemen, or even ladies. He brought up my hand as if to kiss it, as I had heard that foreign gentlemen sometimes do, and instead he nibbled the ends of my fingers. I pulled away, more than startled. His dangling foot lifted, and he was raising my skirt. I stepped back and swished my skirt straight. "Goodness!"
"I beg your pardon. My mistake."
His eyes were laughing.
"You are older than I imagined."
I didn't know how to respond.
"How old are you, my dear?"
"I'm 16, sir." I felt certain that gentlemen shouldn't ask that question of a young lady, but I was just the errand girl, a forgettable niece, and perhaps a gentleman could ask me whatever he would. How was I to know? Who would have told me?
"All of 16. Quite the young lady, aren't we?"
His way of speaking poked and prodded me for weakness. He twisted words to mean more than one thing. "Yes, sir." Or was the correct answer no? I didn't like the way he looked at me. It made me feel small, like a rabbit frozen in fear.
"Fancy that. Miss Martha Sabolt, 16 years of age. Would you care to stay and have a cup of tea with an old bachelor attorney? Just the two of us?"
He stretched out his hand as if to take mine again.
"I'd like to make your acquaintance, my dear."
"No, thank you, sir. I must be going." I backed away, my hands behind me.
"Another time, my dear. Regards to your aunt and uncle."
I passed through the heavy door and down the steps, confused and abashed. I made my way back to the house without daydreaming of Abram or dresses, only thinking that Mr. Montgomery was a strange man who could say the wrong word to my uncle or aunt and cause trouble. What was I to make of his behavior? He'd nibbled my fingers, flipped up my skirt, invited me to a private tea. Who would believe that? I must have misunderstood. I rubbed my hand on my skirt as if to clean his nibbling away and walked faster home. Uncle Daniel was short-tempered. Aunt Rebecca had been weeping, and Nola had supper to cook. She handed Helen back to me, snappish.
"Took your time, girl."
but my fortune.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?